Oh, well, let's begin our third day of Bible study for the week. And I'm aware that not everyone in this room has been here all week, so let me just give a little summary of what we've been up to. The theme for this week's Bible study is sex, drugs, rock and roll. And so on Monday, we looked at David and Solomon and some of their lesser choices and their treatment of women, and talked about what God is truly saying in those contexts and what it means to be a person of faith who's also a person of flesh. And then yesterday we looked at relationships, talking a lot about blessing of unions and marriage and what does that mean for different demographics. And I love that the conversation carried us to talking about senior citizens who might be in a second or third marriage and what a state-recognized union would mean. And looked at Jonathan and David and Ruth and Naomi and discussed loyalty and the different ways that relationships are lifted up and also singleness. We finally ended in Paul. We did have a whale yesterday, so Bible study was a little truncated. Hoping that doesn't happen today. So now we're moving on to the second part of the Bible theme, well, drugs, but really just thinking about substances and addiction. And I'm sure we're all aware that addiction can take a large variety of forms in our lives. So I've listed some text on the sheet. The first Bible passage listed there has been at the top of all of our sheets. Which is just Paul's teaching to the Corinthians, and much of 1 Corinthians deals with the matters of the flesh. And so we use this text as kind of a touch point and a theme verses to carry us through the week. But then we get down to, and I just called today Wednesday Winos, and listed some other texts there. And so those are the ones that we'll actually be looking at today. So the first verse I put on our sheet says, that's actually two sheets. Proverbs says, wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. So a bit of wisdom there from Proverbs. But of course, the role of story and context is vitally important as we understand Scripture and our own stories. So let's get into a story here by going to Genesis 9, the first book of the Bible. We've done some conversation to begin our study, and I'm curious, for those of you who attend different churches back home or are aware of ministries back home, how many of your home churches or places of faith host some sort of AA or NA meeting? Great. And we do, of course, here in the village, too. So it is the role of addiction and the community that builds or does not build, I think is one of those leveling life experiences that it affects everybody in one way or the other. So we'll keep that in mind as we remember that our conversations, whatever shared, can stay in this room, and we honor one another's stories as the sacred texts that they are. So let's look at Noah. We always think of Noah and the flood, but there are some other pretty high points here for Noah. And in the beginning of chapter 9, God establishes a covenant, which was an important word for us yesterday, with Noah. And then we get to the end of Noah's life, and it ends with this really interesting scene. Would somebody else read beginning at verse 20, 9:20 to 9:28?
Noah, a man of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard. He drank some of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, lowest of slaves shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed by the Lord my God be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave. May God make space for Japheth, and let him live in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his slave." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died.
Thank you.
I think the arc of Noah's life is told in an interesting way, and maybe most puzzling is this scene at the very end of his life. We hear of nakedness, and I have the Lutheran Study Bible, and I think that it highlights something that's important, which says, the issue in this story has to do with respect, not sexual activity. This affects both family and national life. Canaan is the father of peoples who are Semitic or Indo-European. Any attempts to justify the slavery of African people misuses this text. So it goes into something else, but... That, you know, we talked about the euphemism in Ruth when she went to lay at Boaz's feet, and that's not my understanding of this story, is that it is truly an issue of respect, some generational protocol, and then of course shame that Noah feels after waking up from his drunken stupor.
Can you explain what Ham did that was... I mean, was it the fact that he did not cover his father like the other two brothers did?
And that he saw his nakedness.
That he saw,
yeah.
Okay.
I think that is the offense.
Okay.
So it gives us a lot of detail as to how the other two brothers went to great lengths to not see.
Does this relate at all to the nakedness of Adam and Eve? I mean, is there something about nakedness that I'm missing here that... special significance?
I don't know that I can offer all the historical significance other than just an understanding that to see your, especially your father naked was, you know, like looking behind the curtain of the Wizard of Oz kind of thing.
So it was just a taboo, a societal taboo.
Yeah, that's my understanding of it anyways.
Well, he didn't act. He says he saw, and then he went and tattled, to his brothers. So he saw something that needed to be addressed, and he chose not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember once, years ago, we were skiing up in northern Minnesota. Late in the afternoon, we saw some people heading out and thought, gee, that's kind of dumb. Went back into the cabin, had our lovely evening, and in the middle of the night, vroom, 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 the snowmobiles were... revved up, and then the next morning the owner of the cabin said, yeah, we have to go out and find these people in the middle of the night. And I kind of went, ha ha, we saw them. And he looked at me and he said, and you didn't say anything to them?
Oh.
And that, I felt shame. And I think there's a parallel. I didn't act. In the culture of the Northwoods, someone out late afternoon who looks like they're from the city, it is your job to say, you know, I think you're not going the right direction. Why don't you follow us? Come on home with us. So, I crossed a taboo there, and I felt it very
On the other hand, he chose to get drunk, and I think he used his son as a scapegoat. So he didn't take any responsibility on himself as, you know, for what he did.
I hear the counselor coming out.
Well, you know,
that's my overall overarching impression of the story too, that it's unjust.
Mm-hmm. I think I am no expert with addiction, but did take quite a bit of interest in studying when I was at seminary in it. And I, if there's anything that I've learned, it's that to approach addiction or substance usage of any kind, one has to understand that substance use and shame are almost intermingled. They are one and the same. And so the reaction of Noah afterwards, to me, rings those same bells of such great shame that there's either going to be, like we've seen with our look at relationships, that flare-up of ego that is excessive and greedy and destructive, or there's the self-giving, but the self-giving is awfully hard to bring out of someone who is altered in some way or the other, dealing with addiction. Not to say that I mean, this is a story of illustration, not the arc of Noah's life. I'm not going to say he's an alcoholic. I certainly wouldn't know.
And I like to think that shame is pretty universal. Yeah. We all have it. Yeah. You know, I like to kind of neutralize it. Everybody's got it about something or other, whether I'm not a good enough mother, I'm an addict, I'm an overeater, I'm whatever. You know, I've never met a person that didn't have shame, and that's not the same as guilt. Mm-hmm. They're two totally different things. Guilt is, I did something bad. Shame is, I am bad.
Mm-hmm. What do you hear in Noah here?
Well, I see that he felt shame, but he wanted to blame his son for it, you know, and that's what a lot of people do when they have any kind of an addiction. It's like they look for someone else to blame. You know, well, if you weren't such a naggy husband, then I wouldn't have to drink a bottle of wine every night, you know, or vice, or, you know, whatever it might be.
Did I miss something here, or Noah was mad at his son, but he subjects his grandson to being a slave? Or was there something more earlier about the grandson?
The being Canaan?
Yeah.
You're right that Canaan is the grandson. And then the representative of the nation.
So he cursed generations.
My notes, and this is a Jewish study Bible, say that the curse of then Canaan and thus the kind of the Canaanites then says it. It's partly an explanation of what is what Israelites saw as perverse sexual practices among Canaanites. So it's got a kind of etiological character. It's kind of an explanatory It's a sort of an explanatory piece of showing how Israelites regarded Canaanites. But these notes argue that it is sexual. It's a sexual innuendo. Here it says that to uncover nakedness means to uncover the nakedness of a man means to have sexual relations with his wife. This makes him guilty of incest.
I'm tired of the story entirely.
That changes everything.
Yeah. Yeah, but then, it's all speculative. Then this makes him give incense in Leviticus 20. The less common expression to see nakedness means to have sex. This would make Ham guilty of homosexual rape. In an effort to explain why Canaan is cursed for Ham's sin, on the other hand, the Midrash sees Ham as castrating his father. This is all quite...
Is that a Jewish Bible?
It is the Dr. Freud entirely, it appears. just as Ham prevented Noah from having a fourth son, so his own son Canaan will be cursed. Blah, blah.
Wait a minute. What was with the blah, blah?
Oh, it just goes
okay, you've got us interested.
with the Greek.
Oh, however,
so we can understand what really
this we'd have to uncover Hebrew.
Something, some text, I'm not sure what the abbreviation is here, suggests that the words saw his father nakedness are better taken literally. So this is another tradition of interpretation. If so, Ham violated two norms, highly stressed, in both the Jewish literature and Rabbinic Judaism, the ethic of bodily modesty and the norm to honor and respect one's parents. So it's just a whole sea of possible interpretations of the words.
Castration, incest, or...
Those would seem like odd things to go tell your brothers about afterward.
Say that again.
If it was either one of those, castration or incest, it'd be odd to then go tell your brothers.
Your dad's naked.
Afterwards.
Yeah. And told his two brothers outside, yeah.
Well, I mean, in a way, like, it is, I mean, like, he could have dealt with it himself. He could have covered his father, but instead he undermined his, because, you know, the head of the family is the one that's supposed to be the godly, you know, the purveyor of God's the earthly representation or holder of God's word, or the head of the family. And so, like, by undermining the father to his brothers, you know, like, it's kind of like, you know, well, maybe father isn't, you know, the one that should be making the rules around here. You know, maybe they're, you know, I don't need to listen to my older brothers because, you know, my the one that's in leadership, you know, got drunk and, he's naked. You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I think the role of shame... And whatever is going on here, the role of shame is the kind of the driving force for these curses that follow. And I think that's just, shame is such a powerful motivator in very, very negative ways.
Mm-hmm. And it can span generations.
Yeah.
Like the legacy of shame can be passed on.
Yeah, certainly. Noah was almost hoping it would be so. I mean, with his curse here, he's saying this is now the tone of the family. So I think, you know, similar to our other conversations and other biblical stories that we've lifted up this week, you know, in our culture, it's a lot more fun to talk about the black and white issues, you know, talk about homosexuality, alcohol, you know, marriage, not marriage, I mean, whatever, sex out of marriage. But I think what we've continued to see in our work here, when we actually get into the story, is that the relationships, the interplay between one person and another, whether it's that base greed or the self-giving, these are the defining matters of our lives, and of course alcohol and sex and relationship play a major role in that, but maybe those are more symptoms of the base issues. So let's see if that carries us to our next example, where alcohol makes a appearance here in the Word. And these stories, these are like three really random stories in the Bible. But we're going to jump to 1 Corinthians 11. And I'm glad to be getting back into 1 Corinthians, since that's kind of our real physical book here with Paul. Um,
And this, well, we'll see what we hear. I'll set it up for us. So we're at 1 Corinthians 11, verses 20 to 34.
When you come together, it is not the Lord's Supper you eat. For as you eat, each of you goes ahead without waiting for anybody else. One remains hungry, another gets drunk. Don't you have homes to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you for this? Certainly not. For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you. The Lord Jesus Christ, on the night he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Therefore, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner, will be guilty of sinning against the body and the blood of the Lord. A man ought to examine himself before he eats of the bread and drinks of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without recognizing the body of the Lord eats and drinks judgment on himself. That is why many among you are weak and sick, and a number of you have fallen asleep. But if we judged ourselves, we would not come under judgment. When we are judged by the Lord, we are being disciplined so that we will not be condemned with the world. So then, my brothers, when you come together to eat, wait for each other. If anyone is hungry, he should eat at home, so that when you meet together, it may not result in judgment.
Thank you.
So this is a very different picture of coming to the Lord's Supper than we typically know. In most of our churches, we line up or circle up and the elements come around and everyone gets a fair share and it's very orderly. What does this sound like?
Sounds like a potluck at my church.
Do you get drunk? Sorry.
When it's the time to discuss the budget, the wine bottle does go around several times. No, I was thinking about the children tend to go first, and mm-hmm. and from there on it's chaos.
Yes. So this, again, this is not an example of drinking alcohol like we typically understand it. I served my internship at a Methodist church, and so we only use juice in communion because it is still their practice that there is no alcohol even allowed in the worship space. And in fact, when they gave a little farewell party for us and really wanted to be able to serve wine, and so we had to party at a different location, which, you know, I think everyone had one glass of wine, but you could not do that inside the church grounds. So I experienced just a total other shift of the role of alcohol and in the church, and this text is a big reason why that practice is still present for the Methodist tradition. So what is the concern here? What's Paul's problem?
Not sharing.
I think it's
greed.
Gluttony. Yeah. But also, it's holding sacred ourselves as the body of Christ. Mm-hmm. What we are ingesting, what we are doing to our own bodies, is we are doing to the body of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Can you set the scene? Because I can't fathom how this works. I mean, if I wanted more wine, I wouldn't get it, you know? I mean, we all get our little sip.
Right.
I remember Thomas as a toddler after communion very loudly, "I want more bread!"
Yeah.
But it doesn't happen we're all very orderly. So what is the
scene?
Yeah,
he doesn't do that anymore.
I mean, there's no good. We don't have an opportunity to get gluttons.
Right.
So what was the practice?
I mean, I can't say from any source other than just reading this, but it sounds to me almost as if you bring your own goods and you feast there in the worship space.
Well, weren't the Romans kind of known for overdoing things?
I think in general, feasting and drinking was a big part of the culture and an all-day kind of affair. Much more than we do now, but certainly our meals are much more truncated, mm-hmm. how we celebrate them.
I think embedded in this is the lack of sharing, too, because some are left with nothing.
While another is drunk.
Right.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the issue of respect again.
Mm-hmm.
Respect for Noah, and here they're not respecting each mm-hmm. other.
Yeah.
I wonder about the attitude toward wine in that culture. I think it had to have been vastly different from our own attitude, because as I understand it, probably the wine was very different from what we know as wine. And you drank wine because you couldn't trust the water necessarily. Mm-hmm. And it didn't have, people weren't driving and drinking for one thing. I mean, you didn't have the consequences of being inebriated as you do in our culture.
I think differently. I think they probably had loads of consequences.
Mm.
They weren't drinking coffee in church. But no, I think people were drunk a lot, and I would guess there was a lot of abuse and...
That's, I guess, what I'm getting around to is that...
A look at colonial U.S.
Yeah.
Which, that was a real problem.
Hmm. The temperance movement didn't start from nowhere. I mean, it was a reaction to
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. I've read some commentary on this verse that talked about how this was maybe marking a time when, well, to this point, the Lord's Supper would have meant a full-on meal, and here it was a meal in which people weren't even really sharing, and this was, and so Paul says, eat at home. Didn't they say that in here?
Yeah.
Eat at home, and then come together, and so then the meal, then the Lord's Supper, then is becoming a little bit more resembling what we think of as a little bit for you, a little bit for you, instead of a full on feast. Because he's saying, take care of that at home, so that the Lord's Supper is genuinely one of equality between everyone, and not a display of some having a lot and others not having any. But yeah, it's definitely a different model from how we think of the sacrament.
Well, and I hear in Paul's strong word that the problem isn't the drunkenness, because he says, well, you go get drunk at home and then come to church. I think, isn't that a very different than how we would see that? I remember on internship a man coming to church drunk, and the president of the church kind of pulling me aside, like, well, do you really think it's appropriate to serve in communion? I guess. Seems as in need as anyone here. But Paul would certainly, it was kind of his Well, if you can't share in church, then go home, feed yourself, drink your wine, and then come to church and celebrate the Lord's Supper. Which also, to me, I hear connection to Solomon's story of the concern was not that he had 300 wives and was very sexually active. I didn't count the concubines, sorry. And not that he was so sexually active and promiscuous. The concern was that his heart would be turned from God. And I hear a little bit of that here with Paul.
Yeah.
That if you're not caring for one another, and if that respect isn't there for your neighbor. I mean, for me, the takeaway here is the verse 33, when you come together to eat, wait for one another.
Hmm.
It's just a simple plea to be aware of those around you.
Hmm, that's a powerful little clause, wait for one another.
And in 22, he's really talking about how they're humiliating those who have nothing.
That shame is right back.
So it's allowing everyone access.
Which is interesting, because I think too often this is read in our modern minds, surely not by our generation, but before, that I better not take communion this week, I'm not worthy. I think that has been a misappropriation. It's different from the wait for one another and share.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially that verse 21, whoever eats the bread and drinks the cup in an unworthy manner. I think that's often been interpreted as being about doctrine, and that if you don't have the right, if you don't understand the right doctrine about the Lord's Supper, you're eating and drinking unworthily. But the whole point here is it's about the quality of their social life together. That's what makes it unworthy eating. It's the inequality and not sharing, not just like an idea. It's about the concrete reality of their relationships that make it worthy or unworthy.
Yeah, there's a plea here not just to take care of one another's physical needs, but social and relational needs as well, which are important. Without interruptions, it feels like about all this time all of a sudden. Let's flip to John. Just go backwards a couple books. Get to the last gospel, John 2. I think this is a really fun story, and it only appears in the Gospel of John. This is Jesus at a wedding, and I'll lead us through this here. And this is also kind of Jesus' first adult ministry. And in John, we don't call them miracles, we call them signs. So what is Jesus revealing here? On the third day, there was a wedding in Canaan of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, standing there were 6 stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now take some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs in Canaan of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
So
So my understanding of a wedding in this day is that it would have been a multi-day affair, and these people had already had a lot of wine and were plenty drunk, and all the wine is gone, and there's just a lot going on here. Jesus' mother is a little pushy. Even after he says, it's not your concern, she kind of still helps facilitate whatever he's going to do. And then we end with, this is Jesus' first sign to reveal his glory. And I just think that's such an interesting phrase, that Jesus' glory is somehow revealed in getting this already completely plastered party even more so. And his disciples believed in him. This story is also unique compared to the other ones that we've talked about today, in that there isn't a sense of, or unless someone else might hear it, but I don't get from this story a sense of shame or the negative effects of alcohol. It's there's a real focus here on what Jesus is doing.
I think it's funny to use the jars for the cleansing. Use those containers to fill the wine.
Yeah. What is that about? And huge ones.
What is that, the cleansing? What is that?
The Jewish rite of purification?
Yeah, what is that exactly?
Do you have your Jewish Bible there?
No, that's the Old Testament. I don't have. Oh. I have a Jewish New Testament, actually, but I don't have it with me.
I mean, it would either be to prepare to eat, I mean, kind of the hand-washing station, or it could be, I want to find it again here.
Well, they're really big, right? 20 or 30 gallons.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, would this have had to do with females' menstruation cycle?
There's a whole lot of ritual purification, right? Mm-hmm. Who wrote that book with that whole thing about codes? Cleanliness codes or purity codes, somebody wrote a whole book on. But the mikvah, the bath, would have needed a bunch of water.
Yeah.
And didn't men also do that for some?
So maybe it was preparation for after the party. Maybe there was a need for purifying.
Sure.
To re-enter society.
I feel like even in asking servants, and I'm not sure here, but I feel like even asking servants who I'm not sure have been purified, and then even asking them to dip water into the tank might have even created an impurity in the system. So I don't know if even that was a bigger deal in terms of talking about purification rites, and maybe there's a lesson there.
My notes make the point, I never thought of this, but that this is an extreme amount of wine. And so it's like the superabundance, and it's making the connection to the superabundance of bread in the feeding story. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really interesting parallel. It's just this sense of abundance beyond need or even desire. It's just overflowing.
Or even possible consumption.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that only abundance, but quality?
Yes, right.
It's better wine.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which has always been a takeaway from this story, that, well, not only does Jesus do this, but it's, you know, it's an A number one primo.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think of the water and the cleansing and the volume of it, these jars being like the body, and that it's then, you know, our bodies are so filled with water, but then to think of the conversion of that into wine, and then the future symbolism of wine is blood of Christ. Like, it just seems like there's some kind of connectivity there.
Hmm.
Well, and also the fact that this is an appropriate use of alcohol, the celebration. I mean, I'm kidding, I'm getting that too. You know, like you're having a wedding and celebrate, enjoy.
Time for rejoicing.
But don't hog it all at communion service.
I mean, I wonder.
Thank you for connecting those two things.
I wonder too if our modern conception of this wine wouldn't be better served if we call it water, because, you know, as Mary was saying, it seems to be
safer than water, perhaps. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
Enhanced water, like we have in dining hall.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, that would also kind of serve to the whole point of them being purification jugs, basically, these giant purification containers, and that back then the wine wasn't necessarily the you know, having some alcohol to celebrate, but they couldn't drink that water. It's not as if it was likely, you know, like, it's not as if it was just like, here's some bottled water, and we went party. It was just like, this is bad water, we can't have, so purified it, made it so they had something to drink.
Another thought is that if there's like an abundance of wine, you don't have to worry about like kind of sharing or like who had how much, like when it runs out and like pointing fingers and blaming, you just get to enjoy the ceremony and the celebration, not get caught up in the sort of logistics that would probably
otherwise. Like at a modern day wedding, you know, wet bar where you come with your drink ticket or there's just so much, it doesn't matter.
Going back to the vessels as a metaphor for our bodies, it's like it's also like the we drink water, but our body makes that into blood, and so like it's like this, the outward what's outwardly cleansing, then we're more accessible, like we're more easily moved by spirit, you know, like there's this like transformation that happens within the body, that, you know, Jesus's presence there, right, like parallel.
And the idea of a great banquet is also an image of the end times, in a strong one, like in Isaiah 25, this great feast where all nations would gather on the mountain and rich wine is before them, well-aged wine. And so it's this image that's like this really strong image in the scriptures, of like God's purpose is being fulfilled ultimately. And so to me, this also is this kind of powerful way of like, this is inaugurating Jesus' ministry. And it's like the banquet has begun, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In reading through this time, I didn't realize, I always thought that the steward was talking to Jesus, but he was actually talking to the bridegroom, which I didn't pick up before. So it's kind of interesting, an auspicious start, it's kind of like Jesus slipping in.
Yeah.
I mean, it says his disciples believed in him, and his glory was revealed, but I don't know if that means anybody was aware that Jesus did this.
Well, actually, the bridegroom frequently a reference to Jesus, so I can see where that confusion went.
All of such incredible insights to these texts. Thank you for the conversation, and today is kind of part one of much like Monday and Tuesday were related with sex and relationship, today we're looking at alcohol, and tomorrow we'll dive a little bit more into addiction. And I even put some of the AA traditions on the bottom of our handout for today. As text that I think is really important to our modern day understanding of substance usage and the role that it plays in our world. And AA has given our culture some incredibly profound ways of looking at community and being together, and especially in the midst of brokenness and shame and addiction. So we will dive more into that tomorrow. Thank you for grappling with these three random texts and being brilliant and honest and open. Pick it up tomorrow.
Thank you.